My name is Chuck Hartley, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Thanks to God, AA, and sponsorship, I've been sober since December 16th, 1988. I have a home group. I go to the Foxhall group, meets every Wednesday in Cary, North Carolina, 8 o'clock. Y'all ever there? My number's in the book. It's not under Chuck H. It's under Chuck Hartley. Can't find Chuck H in the phone book. I have a sponsor. He has a sponsor. I sponsor other men. So I reckon that makes me a member in good standing in Alcoholics Anonymous. Before I get going, I need to thank a few people, Danielle and her committee especially. They did a wonderful job this weekend. They really did. This is a great conference. I had a really good time. Like Mary said, she's very grateful, and so am I, that we don't have those silly speaker ribbons hanging from our name tags all weekend long. I got to participate in this conference in relative anonymity, except when I spoke, and somebody would say, "You're not from around here, are you?" I don't know what gave me away. And that's always nice, too, to be able to just be one of many when you come to a function like this. And I was able to do that this weekend, and I appreciate it. I had a great time. Fellow that brought me down here told me I didn't have to mention him, so Dave Rio brought me down here. He's a good man. He said he only uses his last name when he's being of service. And trust me, folks, he put up with me all weekend long. He was definitely of service. And he brought his buddy Rick with him, and Rick and I clicked and got along. So that if any of y'all know Rick, you know that I'm not really in my right mind. Because when I get along with a fellow like Rick, it just tells me more about myself. I'm probably about as crazy as I've ever been. And I'm really enjoying myself. You know, I'm just a... If any of y'all were at the 11-step workshop yesterday, you heard me say, I'm just a scatterbrain, kind of a drunk. My brain is always going in a million different directions, and it's telling me to do a million different things, and I really need God's help just to get through any given moment, any given day. And, you know, I think they call that ADD, and I've always... You know, I've always had that, you know, and coupled with the alcoholism, you know, it's like, you know, it's like being supercharged. And I needed Ritalin when I was a little kid, but they didn't have Ritalin. They had Paddlin. So I got me a huge dose of that. It didn't calm me down, but it did teach me good manners. And I was just a squirrely kid, you know. I was just one of those kids that needed a sponsor in kindergarten. I mean, any of y'all with me, I just needed somebody I could call that would say, "Oh, for God's sakes, Chuck, eat the cookies, drink the milk, and take the nap." I've just always needed some direction like that. Probably needed a drink. I hung in there. I was a late bloomer. I white-knuckled it till I was 12. By the time I was 12, I needed a drink. And there were a lot of people that would have agreed with that. I had access to a lot of liquor because neither one of my parents drank. But my father was a personnel director at a fairly large factory where I grew up. And back in that days, you didn't get a nice big bonus check. I just read about this Exxon character got like $20 million bonus check. I wish they would have gave some of that to my dad. But they didn't. They gave him a nice bottle of liquor. But he didn't drink. So he put it down in the basement. He had that job probably 20 years before I started drinking. So I had a liquor store down there. And by the time I was 12, I needed a drink, so I knew where to go get one. I didn't know what to get, so I just took the prettiest bottle he had and called a couple of buddies of mine, and we went out in the woods. Should have came to AA the next day. It never really did get any better. We popped the top on that liquor bottle and threw the cap away. I was telling somebody last night, I don't know why they invented caps. Alcoholics sure don't need it. We just need a cork. You know, uncork it, throw it away, start drinking. I never recapped anything. I was 12 years old, had a bottle of liquor. I didn't recap it. I took a big drink, and I gave it to my buddy, and he took a big drink, and passed it to the other guy, and he took a big drink, and it got back to me. Now, I'm not an alcoholic that likes to share, and when it got back to me, it was about half gone. I knew I wasn't going to get a whole lot more of it, so I drank the rest straight down. It was Seagram's Extra Dry Gin. It came in a pretty bottle, that's all I knew, so I drank it. Terrible stuff. Made me sick. I swore I'd never drink it again. That was 40 years ago. I've never drank Seagram's Extra Dry Gin again. But I drank some that night, and I drank it straight down. And what happened to me then happened to me a lot when I was drinking. I drank as much as I could for as long as I could. I got drunk, and it felt pretty good. And I told some good jokes, and I staggered around, and I had a decent time for about 20 minutes. Then I went into a blackout, and I'm a blackout drinker, and I don't know why, but I am. Probably God sparing me the memory of some of the things that I like to do when I drink. But I went into a blackout and insulted my buddies, and they beat me up and took me home, set me on the front porch, rang the doorbell, and ran away, the cowards. My parents came out, found their son in a lump on the front porch, drug me in, let me pass out on the living room floor. Several hours later, I came to. Someone had thrown up on me. So I took myself up to my room and passed out again there. And when I came to the next morning, that same person had gone to work on me. I had a mess to clean up. I felt terrible. Couldn't wait to do it again. Because I'll tell y'all what, that little bit of time between when that liquor hit bottom and I blacked out, I became a part of the world like I'd never become a part of the world before. See, up until then, I had a real good outside going. You know, my dad was a professional man. He took real good care of us kids. He didn't gamble. He set a good example. He quit smoking to set an example for us kids. He never took a drink. He never beat anybody in the house. My mom, us kids, nobody. He took us on family vacations. He never called off sick from work. He was just a really good guy. I thought he was a square, but he was a really good man. Set a good example for his children and took good care of us. And as a result of that, I found myself participating in Boy Scouts, and I was doing all right there. And they took me to school, and I did okay there. And I had some sort of a music talent, and I liked to sing, and I was good at it, and I did really well there. I played a lot of sports. I was never a star, but I always started. You know, just a, you know, kind of like an all-American Norman Rockwell kind of family on the outside. On the inside, I knew I was in the wrong house. My brain told me on a consistent basis, you do not belong here with these nice people. You're absolutely worthless. You're stupid, you're ugly, you don't know what to do or how to do it, and nobody's ever going to show you. You've missed the boat, son. You might as well be dead. And that's the way my brain thought, 24 hours a day. You know, no matter when I came to, that's what my brain was telling me. I come to today, and I wake up today. I don't come to. I wake up today, and they're still there, but now they go, oh, thank God you're here. We've been talking. I need some guidance and direction. But that's what my brain was telling me. And when I took that drink of liquor, those voices quieted down. And I not only was okay, I was exceptional. And you folks were lucky to be in my presence. You didn't know what you'd been missing all of these years. My life changed right then and there. Had a basement full of liquor. It was 1968. There are a lot of... I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio. Everybody here thinks I'm from the South. Well, maybe Ohio from up here is South. But I moved to North Carolina about 5 years ago and already had an accent, and they just worsened it. Went to a big inner-city school in Cincinnati, Ohio. There were 5,000 or 6,000 students at this high school. And it was an inner city school. It was about 85% black. There were armed National Guardsmen walking the hallways of my high school. It was really not a real safe place to be for a little tiny seventh grader like myself that liked to drink liquor and run his mouth. And so I stopped going. And they didn't have computers in 1968, at least not in high schools, not the ones I went to. And with class sizes over 100, teachers didn't know whether you were there or not. They didn't take attendance. If you didn't show off in class, either by being real smart or real not smart, the teachers didn't know you were there. And they didn't have time to bother with finding out whether you were there or not, so you just got to see. And by the time somebody found out I hadn't been to school in a while, I was a rising junior. I'm a child of the 60s and 70s. There are a lot of outside issues in my story, but I'm not here because of outside issues. I'm here because I drink like a pig. And once I start drinking like a pig, I have absolutely no idea what's going to happen to me. I just did what was in front of me, that's all. And because of the time that I grew up, there are a lot of outside issues in my story. I would say that they got me here quicker, but I don't see how. I didn't get here till I was 32, and I was tired. So my life just went like that. I didn't go to school. I stole. I stole from my parents. I stole from other people. I drank every day. You know, I was never one of those drunks that had a compulsion about drinking before noon. You know, I mean, I had to go back home at 3 o'clock. Why wouldn't a morning drink be okay? And I had a lot of drinking to do by 3 o'clock. And that's what I did. I grew up pretty fast. By the time I was 15 years old, I couldn't live with my parents because they had rules that they wanted to be followed, like any normal household would. But I was a self-will run riot little alcoholic, and I knew better than they did. So, you know, I just took off. And got a hold of a fake ID and started working in some construction and made a little money doing the worst jobs someone on a construction crew can do. And I started drinking with those men. And I'd go over and drink in this bar. And one night I was drinking in this bar on this fake ID, and a fella came in there and started giving the bartender a hard way to go. Now, folks, I knew I had a good fake ID for that old half-drunk bartender. But if the police came, it probably wasn't going to pass mustard. So I took care of that guy and convinced him he didn't want to be drinking in my bar where we didn't need his kind causing trouble. And he left, and the bartender was grateful. Turned out to be the owner of the bar. He asked me if I had a job, and I really wasn't working much then. And I said no. He asked me if I had a place to stay. I said no. And he said, I got a room in the back here, and I need my place cleaned up because I'm too old to clean it. You want the job? And I said, sure, I'll take it. He said, good, there's one other perk that comes along with that. I said, what is it? He says, it's a bar tab. Now, if they don't run bar tabs up here, let me explain what one is. That's a 15-year-old with a credit card, is what it is. You drink all week for free, and then you settle up Friday. And there are a lot of other bills that never got paid, but my bar tab always got paid. And I had arrived. We were just starting to date then, me and my buddies. And they were taking their little girlfriends down to 20th Century Movie Theater, and they'd see a movie. Then they'd go over to 62nd Hamburger Joint and get them a hamburger and a little soda pop. And if they were lucky, they got to hold the girl's hand and maybe kiss her when they took her home. I asked them out, took them Lonnie's Lounge. Put it on my tab. As a result of that, you all had a lot of work cut out for you when I got here, because that's how I measured relationships. They came to Lonnie's Lounge with me, they got a plus mark. If they went home with me from there, they got another plus mark, and if they stayed 2 days, we were in a relationship. That's how things went. When I turned 18, my father gave me a job in this factory. And I went to work there, and it was more money than an alcoholic like me had any right to have. And so I went out and bought me a little car. And I didn't have to worry about stealing my booze anymore, so I started drinking whiskey by the half gallon. and I'm drinking and driving and drinking and driving, and one night I drove my car into the back of another car and got DUI. It was an election year, and the judge wanted to make an impression on the fine people of Hamilton County and show them how he dealt with drunk drivers. Even though it was a first offense, he said, I'll give you an option. You can join the Army, or you can go to jail for a year. I thought that was a little harsh, but I did then what I do now. I went and talked to the old-timers, because, you know, in 1974, they still had a war going on, and they said it was winding down, but you couldn't prove it by the body bags coming home, those of y'all of my age or older. And, you know, in my neighborhood, the kids grew up kind of rough, and pretty much they did two things. They either went to Vietnam or they went to the penitentiary. Every one of the kids that I grew up with that went to the penitentiary came home. And not every one of the kids I grew up with that went to Vietnam came home. So I went down to the bar and talked to the old timers. And they said, "Look, dummy." That's kind of a theme throughout my life. "Look, dummy, we think you should join the Army." I said, "Why?" They said, "Well, jail's no fun, for one. And for the second, in the Army, they'll let you drink, and they'll pay you for it." So armed with that information, I stood up and did my patriotic duty and joined the military. Now, lest y'all think I was just some drunken draft dodger that just fell into that deal, I tried to enlist many times before that, but I couldn't pass the physical. You drink liquor the way we drink liquor, sometimes you get too much sugar. And they knew what that meant. They were scratching their head that a 17-year-old kid had sugar like that, but they told me they didn't need me. But with the judge co-signing, I went into the Army. Now, I'd love to regale y'all with a lot of fine military stories. I hear them all the time. But I'm a blackout drinker. They sent me to Germany. And there's two things I can tell you about Germany. They got the best beer I ever drank, and they got some really good outside issues. So I drank a lot of beer, smoked a lot of outside issues, and came home. This factory where I'd been working before I joined the military had taken off in the 2 years that I was gone. The business was booming. And my dad hired me back, and I was making twice the money I was making before I joined the military. And, you know, the only thing worse than a drunk with bad fortune is a drunk with good fortune. And having Daddy as a personnel manager was not a real good fortune for me, because I used it like a club over every supervisor I ever had. So I come and went as I pleased. And more days than not showed up drunk to work. And when I didn't show up drunk to work, I got drunk while I was at work. And I loved to drink liquor. And I was 21 years old, and I needed a nice car to go along with that nice money I was making, so I bought a new Corvette. It was winter time. We had a winter that year of 76, 77, 78, like y'all just had here. Not quite as much snow, but very brutal for the area of the country that we were in. You know, there was always a foot of snow on the ground. It was always below zero. And it was just a nasty winter. And I took that Corvette and half gallons of Jack Daniels and a bunch of outside issues and took the T-tops off and started driving around. When you take outside issues and drink liquor at a half gallon and take T-tops off, it's still a little warm, so you put on your flip-flops and your shorts and your T-shirt and your sunglasses, and you're driving around like that. And I'm wondering why I'm collecting these DUIs. I keep getting DUIs and going to jail and get out of jail and go back to work. And finally, I'd had enough of that. I knew Ohio was my problem. So I took off for California. I went to California three times. I got a buddy back in Ohio that says they should just put a sign on the borders of California, Arizona, and Florida that says this state doesn't work either. About three quarters of us could just come back home. But I missed the sign. And I went to California three different times. I went three different times. We took three different routes to get there. Took three different modes of transportation every time we went. Went to three different parts of California. And every time I got there, there I was. And, you know, the Army did not teach me any skills. And I wasn't willing to learn anyway. I was pretty unteachable back then. And so I got out to California with my sixth grade education, my alcoholism, and my daddy being a personnel director in Cincinnati. And I didn't get real good jobs. So I'd go back home with my tail between my legs, and Dad would hook me up with another job. And next thing you know, I had a little car. And next thing you know, I had a little liquor. Next thing you know, I had DUI. And there I'd be. And one day my mother came to me and she said, we need to talk. I said, okay, Mom, let's talk. She said, you know, your father's been pretty sick lately. And I did know that. You know, my father had to retire when he was 59 years old. He had a series of heart attacks and open heart surgeries that would have killed a lesser man, I think. He had 3 open heart surgeries, 15 bypasses. And back in them days, they were still cracking your chest. He is a tough man. And he endured all of that, but at 59, he had to retire. And she said, it's always been your father's dream. My father lived in upstate New York, a little town called Dunkirk. And they had winters like y'all have winters, and he did not like winter. And she said, it's always been his dream to retire to Florida. I've lived in Florida. I don't know why he dreamed like that. But anyway, that was his dream, and she said, we're going to move to Florida. And I said, that's great, Mom. And she said, I want you to do me one favor. I said, okay, what do you need, Mom? She said, don't ever come to Florida. See, because my parents were always my refuge. And my parents did not have the benefit of Al-Anon. And so every time I came home sick and in need, they'd take me in and clean me up and love me back to health. Almost loved me to death. They loved me so much. But I promised her I wouldn't come to Florida, and off they went. And so they went down there, and I did pretty good for a couple of months. And one day I was driving around, and I was drunk. I wasn't new. And went into a blackout, and that wasn't new. But when I came to, I was surrounded by a lot of police. Now, I'd done things drunk and in blackouts before, you know, 2 or 3 cops. There were about a dozen police officers. I had ran my car into the back of a Mercedes-Benz. My problem was, Mercedes-Benz was a graduation present the local police captain had just bought for his daughter. If y'all ever want to see police in a hurry, do something crazy like that. They were everywhere. And I was getting charged with everything under the book. That was my 9th DUI. Well, you know. I used to drink a lot. I get itchy feet when I drink. I just have to share myself with y'all. It was my 9th DUI. When you got 9 DUIs, you don't have a driver's license, so I got driving under suspension. And when you got 9 DUIs and no driver's license, nobody will give you insurance, so you're driving without insurance. And when you got 9 DUIs, you're on probation, so you got a probation violation. And then they started, you know, hitting me with all the stuff that you get when you ran into a police captain's daughter's car, you know, left to center, spitting on the sidewalk, fleeing and eluding, you know, those sort of things. And they took me to jail. And in Ohio, if you're arrested on a probation violation, there's no bail. So I just sat in jail, you know, waiting my turn to stand in front of the judge so I can go to the penitentiary and do my bit and be done and, you know, get back to whatever little life I had going on. But somebody made a mistake, put me on the bond board for $100. So I called my youngest brother. I have 3 alcoholic brothers. My mother had 5 children. 2 died when they were little children. and the other three of us are alcoholics. And I'm not calling them out of their name. I have a brother that's sober a year and another brother that's been sober before and decided he needed to add to his lead. So those are the kind of children my parents were blessed with. And they tried their best to keep us out of the penitentiary. And they did real good with me and Bill, but they didn't do the two oldest. But the youngest one, he had to go to jail a lot because they ran out of money. And so as a result of that, when John needed some things, they always tried to help him out with that as we got older. And so I told John, call Mom and Dad and tell them some sob story. I don't care what you tell them, but get $100 so I can get out of jail. Well, he called them, and he sobbed real good, and they sent him $200. And he came and got me out of jail and handed me the other $100 and said, I'll see you. I said, hold on, where are you going? He said, I'm going home. I said, yeah, take me with you. He said, well, I can't do that. I said, why not? He said, my wife hates you. I said, well, that's fine. I'm not very fond of your wife either. I said, take me to Bill's house. He said, well, I was talking to Bill before I came down here. And Bill said, you can't go to his house neither. I said, why not? Well, Bill said, him and his wife hate you. Now, y'all, that's where alcoholism had taken me. My parents didn't want me in Florida. My brothers didn't want me in their home. My mother is the youngest of 10 children. And she's the youngest by 7 years. Number nine is 7 years older than my mother. The five children that my mother had were the least amount of children that those 10 children had. I got third cousins older than me. I got first cousins older than my parents. Last time we had a family reunion, we had to rent an amusement park. Because there were over 1,000 of us. And I wasn't welcome in any of their homes. I don't know if I mentioned this or not, but I was a thief long before I was a drunk. If you left it untended, I took it. I also forgot to mention I'm a bad thief. I get caught. And you know, if I steal from one of y'all, if I steal from Rick, Rick doesn't know me. Rick's going to shoot me if he catches me, more than likely, or at least hold me down and call the police. If I steal from my cousin Skip, he's just going to beat me up and kick me out on the front lawn and tell me I can't come to his house anymore. And, you know, when you got as many cousins as I do, you just steal from them. I wasn't welcome in any of their homes, y'all. None of their homes. So I took that $100 from my brother and did what I usually do when I had money like that. I bought a bottle of liquor and a bus ticket to Florida. Oh yeah. And the next day I was knocking on Mom's door, and just like moms do, she took me in and cleaned me up. My dad was none too happy, but there I was. And he got me a job. I don't know how he did it. My dad could always get me a job. And I went to work, and I couldn't keep it very long because my drinking is winding down. I was in Florida a couple of years, and my father passed away. And he wanted to be buried back in Ohio, so we took him to Ohio. And my mother had just lost her best friend of 35 years, and she really couldn't do a whole lot for herself, and she was leaning on her oldest son and expected me to do a lot of things for her. But I couldn't, because all I could do by then was drink. And I drank so much, we put my father in the ground with no help from me at all. But you know, one of those fellas that I took a drink with that first time back when I was 12 years old was in AA. He'd just gotten sober, and he stepped up for me and my family, and he did for my mother what I couldn't do for her. And he never once talked to me about his drinking. He talked to me about his drinking. I knew about his drinking. I was glad that he was in AA. He needed to be somewhere where he didn't drink. But he had a light in his eye, and he was of service to me and my family. And when all was said and done, I did not get sober, and I did not ask him any questions. I said, good for you, and I'll see you. And I went back down to Florida and started drinking again. Wasn't down there long, and my mother needed me to go to Ohio and sell some property for her. And I went up, and I sold this piece of property for more money than she asked for. And like a good son, I sent her share, and I kept the rest and stayed in Ohio. And that was the last bit of money that I didn't even earn that, but at least... you know, I'd had something to do with it, but that was it for me and work. And when that money was through, so was I. I'd been homeless for a while. If I didn't stay at my mother's place, I was homeless. And with her in Florida and me in Ohio, I was homeless for a couple of years before I got sober. And I was staying in an abandoned hobo shack on the Little Miami River in Ohio. I never want to forget that place. It was four walls and a tar paper roof and a dirt floor with a hole in the middle so you could go to the bathroom. There wasn't no water. There wasn't no electric. There wasn't no lights. There wasn't anything in this place. Just me and the other drunken hobos. And I was drinking cheap vodka. And I wasn't sleeping anymore. I was just drinking until I passed out. And while I was passed out, I'd go into the DTs and they'd jerk me awake. And I'd crawl over in the corner and drink some more out of that vodka bottle until I'd pass out. And that was my life. When I ran out of vodka, I'd go down to the store and hawk over whatever poor clerk was working there and steal from them. And I'd go back to the riverbank and do it all over again. And one day I came up off of that riverbank and I had a little bit of change in my pocket, so I started heading to this bar that I liked drinking. It really wasn't a bar. It was more of a knife and gun club. And people died in this bar. It wasn't in a real nice... It was in a bad section of the bad section of town. And I went to this bar to drink. And as I was walking towards that bar, I had this overwhelming feeling that today was going to be the day that I died. Because, y'all, I like to run my mouth when I get drunk, and I knew it. I just couldn't stop myself. And just like I wasn't a very good thief, I wasn't a very good fighter either. And none of these teeth are mine. They're all store-bought. And I wasn't real physically healthy anyway. I'd been cut out of a couple of cars, and I'd been shot at and stabbed and beaten half to death, and just wasn't feeling real good, and I knew it was my day. But a little tiny voice inside of me said, you know, we don't want to die. Why don't you call this Greg guy and see if he's still sober? So I called Greg. And Greg came down there and took a look at his lifelong friend and burst into tears. And I knew I was in trouble then, boy. Because Greg drank like I drank. And, you know, men just didn't cry where we grew up anyway. And he took me to his house. And I weighed 307 pounds when he took me to his house. My blood pressure was so high I couldn't wear tight shoes. I had to wear slip-on shoes because I'd pass out if I'd bent over to tie. And I didn't have any teeth, three or four. And I didn't bathe. I hadn't told you the last time I bathed. My hair was long and stringy. My beard was long and stringy. I'd stopped going to school in the sixth grade. Between all the liquor and the outside issues, I couldn't read. I couldn't write. I couldn't do basic math. I couldn't even sleep. And Greg took me into his house and rocked me to sleep. He laid me on his couch, and him and his family nursed me back to health. His wife filled me. Somebody told this poor woman that alcoholics like sugar. And this poor woman shoved so much sugar down my throat. I was drinking orange juice with sugar, orange juice with carob syrup, and soda pop, chocolate, anything with sugar in it, and this guy was giving it to me. I have diabetes today. I call Edie up on a regular basis. You know, just to mess with her like I did Danielle. I go, Edie, you know, it's your fault I'm taking this medication for diabetes. I didn't eat no sugar till I met you. We had fun. And his children were on winter break. And they kind of liked having a immovable object on their couch. They were 12 and 10, two little girls when I got sober. And you know, 12 and 10-year-old girls are learning how to do things. You know, they're like makeup. And they had a dummy laid out on the couch. And they practiced their putting makeup on me. I'd come to and start sharing the language of the street with those two beautiful children. They didn't know what I was talking about, but they knew it wasn't any good. Them gals, those two gals, thought it was funny that a grown man couldn't read, so they made it their mission to teach me. And they'd teach me how to read, and when I was passed out, they'd make me look like Bozo the Clown. When I'd share the language of the street with them, they'd say, you know, we don't know what you're talking about, but we know it's not any good, so you need to stop that. And if you don't, we're going to tell our daddy, and he'll beat you up. You know, I was feeling kind of puny, so I knew Greg could get the job done. So I got to win twice with God working through two beautiful children. I got to learn how to read again, and I got to learn how to clean up my mouth. And Greg would take me to meetings. And you know, there's a movement on, I think, in AA for an easier, gentler, softer kind of way. Somebody didn't tell Greg that. Because he'd come home from work, and I'd say, how you doing, brother? And he'd say, get in the car. And I said, where are we going? And he said, don't worry about it. I've checked your calendar. There's absolutely nothing on it. Now get in the car. So I'd go get in the car and he'd take me to an AA meeting. First time he took me to an AA meeting, a fella stood up and said, thanks for 2 years sober. And I stood up right behind him and said, you're a liar. Nobody can stay sober that long. They had a wild man on their hands. Greg was living in the suburbs when he came and rescued me. Those poor folks didn't have any idea. They'd never seen someone like me before. Like something they'd go to the zoo and look at. Look, honey, a real-life street urchin. And I wandered away from Greg one day and stumbled into a discussion meeting. And there I sat unattended, so I stood up to share my experience, strength, and hope with you five people. By 3 days. And an old-timer stood up, and he said, boy, you need to shut up and sit down. And my ego wouldn't let me do that, so I said, old man, you need to go to the street, and I'm going to throw you out the window there and take bets on how many times you bounce before you hit. And I went to go get him. And y'all gang-tackled me. I couldn't believe it. There I was in a Meet Alcoholics Anonymous getting gang-tackled. And I'm yelling and screaming and cursing and thrashing around and trying to bite people. If I'd have had teeth, I'd have left some marks. And here's this old man standing off to the side laughing at me, going, keep coming back, boy. It's funny now, it wasn't funny then, but I tell you what did register with me was me acting a fool and hearing somebody telling me it's okay to keep coming back. They didn't stand me up and say, you got to go. We don't allow your kind in here. You come back when you can act better. Nah. They just said, why don't you take the cotton out of your ear, stick it in your mouth, sit down here and take a listen to what we got to offer. I said, what do you got to lose? We can look at you and tell 1988 wasn't a real good year. So I did just that. I heard a lot of talk about sponsorship. I wouldn't understand any of it, so I went to Greg and I said, what about this sponsorship? He said, you don't have to worry about that. I said, why not? He said, I'm your sponsor. I said, now I've been listening, and these folks say that they ask people to be their sponsor. And he said, well, Chuck, let me tell you a little something. After your first meeting there, we took a vote on who'd be your sponsor. And I lost. So my buddy Greg took me through the steps. Yeah, are you powerless over alcohol, Chuck? I said, I don't know. And he'd say, when you take a drink, can you go home? I said, sometimes. He said, when you take two drinks, can you go home? And I said, sometimes. And I could tell he was starting to get irritated with me, so I finished up for him. I said, Greg, if I take three drinks, I cannot tell you what state I'll finish up in. He said, that's good enough. He said, is your life unmanageable? He said, hold on a second. You're sleeping on my couch. You've taken step one, dummy. Congratulations. He said, now let me tell you about step two. He said, you better hope there's a power greater than you that can restore you to sanity, because you are the craziest cat I've ever met in my whole life. If anybody needed restoring to sanity, Chuck Hartley, it is you. Well, I couldn't really argue with him on that point. And then he said, congratulations, dummy. You've completed step two. Now get on your knees. And I said, Greg, we've been friends for a long time. I was kind of raw, you know. He said, no, dummy, we're going to pray. Now, I'll tell y'all something. I wasn't real keen on this praying stuff, you know, because I was brought up to go to church. And, you know, they explained to me all this stuff about God. And all the deacons of the church talked to me about God and what a sinner I was and how I better get with their program so that I can get saved. And then I start drinking and I start carousing the streets at night. And what do you know? I see these deacons sneaking out of the back of the bar around 2 a.m. with women that weren't their wives. And then they show up on Sunday morning talking that mess. So I knew I didn't want what they had. And you all just heard me talk a little bit about the kind of life that I led. Now, if that's a blessing from God, I sure wasn't going to check in and you know, let him know where I was. Yeah, up until that time, I'd done a pretty good job of being a moving target, and my life still wasn't, you know, where I wanted it to be by any stretch of the imagination. But I got down and I said the words with him. And he knew that I was struggling with that. And he said, let me ask you something, Chuck. He said, I know you're having a hard time with this God deal. He said, but do you believe that I believe there's a God? And I said, yeah, Greg, I've heard you talk. You sure do. He said, why don't you just use my God then until you can get one of your own? So I done that. And our big book talks about, you know, we only have to make a little beginning, you know. If we take little steps towards God, he'll take big steps towards us. And that was the case with me. I sure didn't come in here looking for him, but kind of hard to deny the work that he's done. My mother moved back from Florida because she wanted to be near her family. And she was on a fixed income, and I was on a fixed income. By this time, I had a little job at Hardee's, and I was making enough to get by. She and I rented a place together. And y'all, my mother lived in a robe, a long robe. And it was a robe that she took and altered for herself and sewed many, many pockets into the inside of this robe. Because my mother raised three alcoholic thieves. And anything of value that my mother held near and dear to her heart went in the robe. And I mean anything. There was money in the robe, of course, and credit cards in the robe. But there were recipes in the robe, and old pictures in the robe, and old report cards in the robe, and real jewelry in the robe, and fake jewelry in the robe. If it meant something to my mother, it was of value to her, and it went in the robe because she didn't want her children to steal it from her. And we were sitting around one day, and she excused herself. She had to go to the bathroom, and I thought, you know, these AA people are always teaching me about practicing good manners. I think I'll go get my mom's coffee cup there and refill it for her and get her hot coffee while she's gone. So I went to do that, and there down in her chair sat her wallet. Now, I hadn't seen her wallet since I was about 6 years old. And so I said to myself, you know, I'm going to tease my mother. I know y'all can't believe that I like to tease stuff. But I said, I'm going to tease my mother about, you know, her getting old. And, you know, the first thing to go when you get old is your memory. And menopause, woman pause, anything kind of pause will get that memory going. So I'm going to tease her. And she came back, and I start teasing her about her memory being bad. She said she didn't know what I was talking about. I'm going to tell you all something. I'm going to tell you a little bit here about all of the wonderful things that have happened to me as a result of turning my will and my life over to the care of God and just relaxing and letting Him and y'all have your way with me. But if none of those things had happened to me, if just this one interaction with my mother had happened to me, I'd still be here tonight. I'd still be speaking. I'd still be sober. I'd still be doing all the things that I do in Alcoholics Anonymous because of this. I teased my mother about not ever seeing her wallet, and she must be getting old and her memory failing, and she said, I didn't forget my wallet, Chuck. I trust you. Dang, I've been telling that story almost 20 years. Still makes me cry. But y'all had a lot more work to do with me. And I started going to meetings. I went to meeting every day. I was 2.5 years sober before I missed a meeting. I didn't know I could. All I heard was get in the car. So I went to meetings. And I took these steps. And I let you all have your way with me. And I was crying to my mother about not even having any education, not even a GED. And she said, honey, you've got a GED. And she went in a robe and pulled out a GED with my name on it. Now, y'all, I was dumbfounded, say the least. It took me a long time. I was probably about 10 years sober before I put together all of the pieces because my brothers and I were not close when I first got sober. But my youngest brother is 5 years younger than me. And when I went in the Army, he was already drinking. And I didn't want him to have the hard time trying to get an ID that I had, so I gave him mine. And when I got out of the Army, I had no need for that ID, so I just never asked for it back. And at one point in time, my brother went and took a GED test. And the only ID he had said Chuck Hartley. So he had no need for it, so Mother took it and put it in the robe. I was instantly several IQ points smarter. I took my newfound education to my friends. Because when I got sober, I hung out with all the young people in AA. I was 32 years old, but I hung out with young people because, you know, adults scared me. Never mind that I was older than some of the adults I knew. Y'all scared me. You had all the answers. You seemed to know what was going on. And the young people, they didn't care if they had the answers. Didn't matter how long they were sober. They were just enjoying being young, happy, joyous, and free. And they didn't judge. Young people don't judge old men that can't read. So they let me hang out with them, and I had a great time. And they had energy, and you needed energy to keep up with me then. And I started snivelling to them. I had one buddy in particular named Jeff that was going to college, like a lot of young people do. And I started whining to him. And I said, Jeff, I wish I could be like you, brother, going to college and getting a good education. He said, well, why don't you? And I said, Jeff, do you know how old I'll be in 4 years if I go to college? And he said, no, dummy. How old are you going to be in 4 years if you don't go to college? Well, I've just gotten that GED. So I did the math. And I'll be doggone. It was the same answer. So I took off to Voc Rehab and told them my little tale of woe. And when they got done crying, they said, oh, we'd be glad to help someone like you. They couldn't believe it. You know, that day and age, someone could go through their life and be illiterate. And so they sent me to college. And this is going to just tickle the heck out of you. Well, it tickles the heck out of me. I had to take a battery of tests because they wanted to get their money's worth, so they wanted to place me in a major where they thought I could do the most good. And when I got done taking their tests, here's what they determined: that a homeless city boy, a drunk, kind of a low-life street urchin should be, that I'd make a fine social worker. See, now up until that point, my idea was, just kill them all and let God sort it out. Now they want to send me to school to be a social worker. So I said, okay. And I just didn't argue. Y'all taught me early on that, Chuck, you don't have any skills anyway, so just let us write on you, brother. I was a clean slate, so I did, And they sent me to school to be a social worker. And like I said, I had no idea how to go to school, so I asked you guys. I said, how do you go to school? And they said, well, Chuck, there are a lot of different ways to go to school, but you've been out there drinking for so long, we think you should go to school the AA way. And I said, really? What's that? They said, go to class early. I said, okay, we do that in AA. They said, sit in the front row. Okay, I can do that. They said, while you're sitting there, there's going to be a speaker come out and take the podium. Shut up and listen to him. Oh, okay, I can do that. While he's there, he's going to talk on a lot of different subjects that you know nothing about that he does. Pay attention. While he's doing that, he's going to suggest that you buy and read some books and maybe do what they say. We suggest you do the same thing. So that's what I did. Because I didn't know how to go to school. I mean, I didn't know how to take notes. I didn't know how to do lesson plans. I didn't know how to study for tests. I didn't know how to do any of that. But you all had taught, were teaching me how to pay attention. And so I did that. I went to school the AA way. And I did pretty good. And 4 years later, it's time for graduation. And we're sitting around talking, me and the folks that I went through school with. And they had a little reception for us, and we're all chatting and drinking punch and blah, blah, blah. And the dean of the college is shaking everybody's hand. And are you going to go to grad school? Oh, yes, Dean. Are you going to go? Oh, yes, I can't wait. And he got to me, and he said, Chuck, are you going to go to grad school? I said, no, I can't, Dean. And he said, why not? I said, well, I can't afford to go. I said, Voc Rehab sent me to undergraduate school. Through all of this, and I'll talk about it in a minute, I got married, and we were raising two children, and all that good thing, and I'll get back to that, but I said, I'm doing all of this, and I got the AA going on, and I try to go to a meeting every day and just follow directions, and I just really can't afford to go to graduate school. And he said, will you go if I pay for it? Well, I'll tell y'all what, my drug of choice has always been Three and More. Now, if we're spending my money, of course, we're going to drink Jack Daniels by the half gallon. But if we're spending your money, I don't care. Three and More is wonderful. It's the best drug a guy could ever have like me. So my drug of choice being Three and More, I said, heck yeah, Dean, I'll go if you pay. So he did. And he sent me to, paid my way through graduate school, and 2 years later, I had a master's degree in social work administration. And I'm going to tell you all what. If any of you are sitting around here today wondering if there's a God, and wondering if he has your best interests at heart, and wondering if there's any way that a God that those of us that have been here for a while talk about has love, care, and concern for a bunch of terrible, low-life, gutter drunks like ourselves, let me tell you, you cannot go from homeless, illiterate, to a graduate degree in social work administration in 10 years, anywhere else but in Alcoholics Anonymous, with the loving hand of the God that I've come to understand here. There's just no way. See, because my sponsor told me early on that, Chuck, you need to give 100%. And if you give 100%, only if it's 20% of what needs to get done, God will make up the rest of it every single time. And I had no reason to doubt you all, so that's what I did, with full expectance that he would deliver every single time, and he sure has. As long as I'm giving my all, God's given his all, and his all is so much greater than mine. you just can't get a graduate degree in 10 years with the tools that I went to start at school with. You just can't do that. And so thank you, AA, for teaching me how to learn and for giving me the opportunity to be self-supporting through my own contributions. I didn't know how to date. I told you all how I dated. But I wanted to date, so I went to you guys and I said, how do you date? And they said, well, dummy, most of us know how to date already, but we've heard you and we're going to tell you. Here's how you do it. First of all, you got to find a gal dumb enough to say she'll go out with you. I said, I've already done that. They said, good. Here's what you do. You'll go to her house and you'll knock on her door. And she'll answer the door and you'll walk her out to your car. And when you get to the car, open the door for her so she can get in. Keep the door open, Chuck. Wait till she gets all the way in. Had no skills. Once she's in, shut the door. Go around to your side, get in the car, and go to your little date. You're probably going to go to Denny's or something and have coffee and then go to a meeting. But go to your little date and drink your little coffee and just chit-chat with the woman. Don't tell her any dirty jokes. Don't be vulgar, you know. And when you're done with that, take her home back to her place, walk her to her door. When she opens the door, tell her good night, that you've had a wonderful time, and then you leave. I said, no, that's where I go in. No, dummy. We're trying to start a new deal with you here. This is where you say thank you for a nice evening and you go home. And I did that. And I did it a couple of more times. And this gal, for whatever reason, decided she liked my company. So we decided to date exclusively. Not that either one of us was dating anyone else anyway. But she's been sober 6 months longer than I have. Never lets me forget it. She'll wake up in the morning and go, I need some coffee, new guy. So we started dating. And her drinking life somewhat mirrored my own. And she had two small children when we started dating. They were 8 and 6. And so we had some talking to do. Were we going to have a sexual relationship? Both of us wanted to have one, but both of us knew a little bit, thanks to good sponsorship, about the pitfalls of jumping into the sack too early in a relationship. So being as how we were a little bit older, both of us were in our 30s at the time, and being as how we'd both had sex before, she had those two children, she took my word for it. I knew she'd had sex at least twice. We decided to keep our clothes on and just court. And thank you, AA, for teaching me that. Because what happened was 2 years later, I not only got to marry the woman of my dreams, I get to marry my best friend. Because when you don't bring sex into it, you got to talk a lot. And she and I had a lot in common. And we share a lot of the same viewpoints. And we were raised essentially in the same type of environment. And we fell in love. And we fell in like. And July the 11th, we will be married 16 years. Thanks to folks like you showing us what to do. We are having just a heck of a good time of being together and doing this deal. Because we made a pact a long time ago that in our household, God was always first. And that in our household, Alcoholics Anonymous would always be second. And on a good day, when I'm not thinking too much about me, she can be third. And then everything else just kind of filters down the line. And we've lived like that for almost 16 years, and we have a wonderful time together. And we got to raise those two children. And I'll tell you what, that was no easy feat for a guy like me. I'd never had any children, didn't particularly care for children, used to pinch my nephews and nieces when they'd come over so that they'd cry and their parents would take them home. But Beth's daughter, my daughter, is this beautiful little blonde-haired, blue-eyed child. When they're looking up at you like that and saying, "Daddy, can I?" You know? How can you not love that stuff? It sure makes me see the relationship that I have with God, because that's what I do a lot, too. You know? I just roll my eyes up and say, "Daddy, can I?" What beautiful kids they are. Our son is the oldest. He's 26 today. He joined the military when he was 20. They saw something in him that nobody else did. And, well, I guess without going into a whole lot of explanation, they taught him how to kill people and sent him to Iraq. And he didn't do well there. I mean, he did well. He did the job they trained him to do, but it didn't set well in his mind, and they brought him home. And he does the very best that he can. But a lot of days, that's not real good. Our daughter always wanted to join the military. When she was in the seventh grade, they had them do career choices, and she said, "I want to go in the Army." And when she graduated from high school, that hadn't changed. And she joined the military, and she's 24 today, and she's still in the military. And she's having a great time. A year and a half ago, they sent her to Iraq. And when the women get to Iraq, the first thing they do is give them a pregnancy test. And she'd been married for a year, but they weren't planning on having children just yet. But, you know, this is God's deal, not her deal. And the pregnancy test came back positive, and my daughter got to leave that war zone. I'm very grateful for that. They brought her back to the States. You know, Uncle Sam doesn't care if women die in a war zone, but they care a whole lot if dependents do. And they brought her home. And July the 4th, 2007, I became a grandparent, a beautiful little girl named Jaylee Nicole. And I'm spoiling her now, but she doesn't know it, and I can't wait till she's old enough to know it. We made plans to go to Texas for her first birthday. We figure she'll be about 10 before she finds out that all those parades and balloons and fireworks aren't for her. But we're going to play it up until then. If you're sitting in here and you're new today, I hope what you've heard is that it's possible to do anything here in Alcoholics Anonymous. That it doesn't. We don't care how bad you were. We don't care how mean you were. We don't care how anything you were. That there's not anything that you could have done that'll enable you to unique yourself out of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you got a problem with drinking, you belong right here. And just like they told me in 1988, if you're new here, we already know more about you than you know about yourself. And the biggest thing we know about you so far is 2008 has not been a good year. But come on in and sit down and join us. Because we need you here and we want you here. And there's nowhere else in the world that I'd rather be right now than in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you for my life.